Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We do not have a quorum, but I will call the meeting to order when we do. Sorry for the late start, but there was traffic congestion in the elevator today, apparently, according to my capable staff, so we'll accept their excuse today. We have a budget overview from the Department of Transportation. Is the first thing on the agenda. If they want to come forward, that would be appreciated. You could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tracy Hatch. I'm the Deputy Commissioner and also the Chief Financial and Chief Operating Officer for the Department of Transportation. So, Mr. Chair, you had asked a number of questions, and so we're here to address those questions in presentation form, but of course I can take questions as well that come as we go at your will, sir. And there's quite a bit of material to get through, so I'm just going to dive in. So wanted to start with the program and budget structure for the department. You'll see this is actually how our budget bills, the appropriations bills, are split out as well. A number of the questions that the committee had was around specific amounts that are planned spending for fiscal 18 and fiscal 19, particularly in the state roads program, and I'll walk through that here a little bit more specifically. But the department is funded in four major program areas. We have the multimodal systems program, which encompasses aeronautics, transit, freight, which is the principally the non-highway freight, but we do have some freight that moves by, of course, the highway, and passenger rail. We also have a local roads program, which includes our funding for our county and municipal state aid systems. We have the portion that's on the right side of the screen, the state roads program and the agency management program. That's principally the trunk highway funded areas. The state roads program has three big components. The program planning and delivery area, and I'll get in a little bit more specifically here in a few minutes about what's included in that activity. But I should also mention that the headings, so multimodal systems, local roads, state roads, and agency management, are considered programs, and then those sub-bullets are all considered what we call budget activities. So, the primary budget activities in state roads include program planning and delivery, and I'll explain what's included in that in a little bit. State road construction, and that's just like it sounds, that's our big state road construction budget. Principally, those funds go to contractors, prime contractors working on construction jobs. We also have debt service. That's our annual big debt service payment. It also includes local government advances and any repayment of transportation revolving loan fund loans. And then we have our operations and maintenance area, and that's just like it sounds. That's the operations and the maintenance that take place actually on the roadway. The way I always like to talk about operations and maintenance is maintenance are things that extend the life of an asset, and operations are things that help the system run smoothly, things like debris removal, snow and ice removal, striping, things like that. And then agency management, it comprises about, depending on how you look at our budget, about 3 or 4% of our budget. It includes what we call agency services. I'll get into that here again in a little more detail in a bit, but agency services are things such as finance, communications, human resources. A lot of IT spending comes out of that category, that type of thing. And then buildings. We have over 1,000 buildings located throughout the state, and so we have a pretty big chunk of that agency management total, which we get about $44 million a year for that, goes towards buildings, maintaining all of those facilities throughout the state. So I'm going to take that kind of big swath, and I'm going to do a little deep dive in a few sections. This shows the appropriations by type. So direct appropriations, which is what you'll deliberate here probably most on over the next several weeks, and those are expenditures that you just directly appropriate to the agency. The majority of the items on the previous slide are funded by through direct appropriations. Statutory appropriations include things like a statutory designation that we can issue a permit and collect a fee for that permit to offset the cost of providing that service. That's an example of a statutory appropriation. And then an open appropriation the print, kind of two main open appropriations we have are this, which represents our systems billing for statewide systems. We have an open appropriation for that. That principally comes out of the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. Another example of an open appropriation that we get is for debt service. So this is just in graphic form showing the expenditure type. Again, the bulk of our expenditures come from direct appropriations. This breaks down in more detail, and I presume the handout that you have probably is a little clearer to read than the slides. But this breaks down our expenditures by fund. I should also mention that all of this information that I'm going over is also included in our biennial budget document. And at the bottom of the slides, for example, on page 4 in our biennial budget document, you'll see this broken out in a different format, but the same information. So this breaks down the major funds that we have, the Trunk Highway Fund obviously being the largest fund that the department utilizes. We also get a number of federal funds. The federal funds that you see on this chart do not represent the federal funds that we pull in into the Trunk Highway Fund for our state road construction program. This federal fund line would represent additional federal funds that we receive, in some cases from FHWA, in the form of discretionary grants or state planning and research dollars. However, the bulk of that federal fund line would be things like federal funding that comes, for example, to the Office of Transit to fund transit activities, any of the other program areas that we have that receive federal funds. We receive a little bit of general fund. The bulk of the general fund dollars represented there are for our transit program, Greater Minnesota Transit. We get a little bit of general fund, $500,000 a year, that goes towards passenger rail, and we get a little bit that goes into our freight area. You'll also see special revenue. You'll see throughout the presentation a little bit later, I'll point it out. We refer to a lot of the special revenue accounts as 2000 fund accounts, or you'll see later in the presentation they're referred to as partnerships. So what happens is special revenue accounts typically are accounts where, by statutory authority, we set up an account where we can bill a local entity for their share of a project, for example, or they can pay for their share of a project, and rather than putting it into the Trunk Highway Fund, because it would not be legal spending out of the Trunk Highway Fund, we put it into a special revenue fund. Another example that we use for special revenue funds is our damage restitution program. And you'll see that again spelled out a little more clearly later in the presentation. But damage restitution is a pretty big deal for us. That's where if, let's just say someone runs into a cable medium barrier. I'll use that example because I did that once. Minnesota State Patrol will put a yellow tag on that piece of infrastructure that's damaged, and it will have a case number, and then that case number will link back to the individual or their insurance, and then we repair it and then effectively bill the insurance company for the cost of that. There are some cases where it's not collectible or it's such a de minimis dollar amount or something like that, but in general, that's what damage restitution is. And then we take those funds in, and then they end up getting credited back to the Trunk Highway Fund portion that's spent back. And then you'll see those other funds, which we wanted to include today, but I know that they weren't part of their original request. The Transit Assistance Fund, the Municipal State Aid Systems Fund, the County State Aid Highway Fund, the State Airports Fund, and then other. There's just some other, you know, small uses in some other fund categories. This, again, is just a graphical representation of the previous slide. Probably harder for you to see here, but it just shows the order of magnitude of each of those. So here, again, I'm going back to that very first slide I showed where I broke it down by program and budget activity. This is the expenditures that we just covered, but, you know, sliced and diced in a different way. So this shows all of those expenditures that are planned for 18 and 19, as well as 16 and 17. And this is according to current law. So effectively, that's Chapter 75 that passed in 2015. But this shows how we're planning to spend or how we have spent those dollars according to those four program areas. And you can see, of course, the bulk of the spending is in the state roads program. And for the local roads program, the bulk of those dollars actually go out to the local cities and counties.
Ms. Hatch, Representative Runbeck has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I might be asking you to go back to the previous slide, but talking about transit. It's up there, isn't it?
Transit assistance.
Okay. Could you, and I'm looking at your narrative a bit, but what are the receipts into that fund? Where do those monies come from? I see what you're spending, but $48 million, where are those receipts from?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the bulk of those dollars come from the transit assistance fund itself. The general Greater Minnesota Transit also gets some general fund money, but these dollars come from the motor vehicle sales tax, the 40% that go to transit. And then of the 40% that go to transit, 4% of that goes to Greater Minnesota Transit. It also would include MVEST. I'm drawing a blank. Sorry. I'm looking at my whiz over there and I can't hear him. Lease tax. Thank you so much. The motor vehicle lease sales tax. Yes. And then, like I say, there's an additional component that goes to Greater Minnesota Transit that's not represent that would be represented in the general fund line and not the transit line there.
All right. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. So this, again, is now narrowing in just on the trunk highway fund portion of expenditures by budget activity. And this should all tie back to effectively to the Chapter 75 that passed in 2015. So there's some funding for aeronautics that come out of the Trunk Highway Fund. That is principally to provide air transportation service and to fund air transportation service, pilot salaries, and the like that are used to, how do I describe that? Those funds sit out there and then are charged, are billed to when that air transportation service is provided. So it isn't automatically provided to aeronautics. It's a charge. So as the department utilizes the aircraft for trunk highway eligible activities, then those are billed. There is funding that goes to Greater Minnesota Transit. That's in the current appropriations bill. There's, again, funding that goes to freight, the bulk of this funding. In fact, the bulk of this funding goes to fund our commercial vehicle inspector section in the Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations Office. So this is a group of folks that help to orient new carriers to the regulations. They do audits, in some cases desk audits, in some cases on-site audits, vehicle inspections, et cetera, for trucks. We also have a permit section that is included in that freight area for oversized, overweight carriers if they want to haul heavy or on a load-restricted bridge or area. They have to get a permit, and then they have to we route out for them how they can safely navigate that area. There's also a piece of that funding in the freight area that goes to pay for trunk highway expenses related to cooperative agreements with local units of government or railroads. So in cases where we have a trunk highway, for example, that intersects a railroad or a trunk highway that would maybe intersect a county road or a municipal road and a railroad, the portion of that that's eligible and attributable to the trunk highway work is charged there as well. Program planning and delivery, I'll come back to that on a future slide that will show a little more detail. And state road construction is just as I described it earlier. That is the, kind of what we call hard construction. It's the actual construction contracts, typically with the prime contractor. Operations and maintenance, again, I'll go into that in a little more detail here in a minute. Statewide radio communications. So MnDOT has a group of a section, an office, that provides statewide radio communications that principally is, we do the installation and the operations of it, and we are principally paid to do that from the armor system, which and the 911 fees. And that is sort of all owned by DPS, and they effectively have asked us to build the system, and then they pay for the bulk of that. What you see here, and I should also mention that I believe all of the sheriffs and all of the local, or the bulk of the local 911 system is now on the ARMR system. So it's a statewide emergency system. And what you see here as expenditures, this goes to pay for the portion of that that is utilized by MnDOT. We also have our maintenance forces and our operations forces and also our construction folks that are on that system on a different frequency, but also on that system. And so this pays for our portion of that system use. I should just briefly mention that when the bridge collapsed, that system was in place in the local area, and that was so critical and so important to be able to connect with all of the local law enforcement through that system. And then we have agency services. I did mention agency services a minute ago, and I'll go into that a little bit more detail, as well as building services there. And then the debt service you see reflected there does not include our annual debt service payment. That actually is just our transportation revolving loan fund payments and our local government advances.
Thank you, Ms. Hetrin. Just take a little pause here because we have a quorum, and I will officially call today's meeting of the House Transportation Finance Committee to order. Members, we've just gotten the copies of the PowerPoint hot off the press, so they'll be handed out here momentarily. In the meantime, I have a dilemma. You know, Representative Johnson is not here, and in fact, he cannot approve the minutes from yesterday. But Representative Nelson was kind enough to point that out. So, Representative Nelson, let's start with the minutes from February 21st, if you don't
Mr.
mind.
Mr. Chair, I'll move approval of the minutes from February 21st, 2017.
Nelson moves that the minutes from February 21st be approved. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Those minutes are passed. And then from yesterday's meeting, Representative Nelson.
And I move approval of the February 22nd, 2017 minutes.
He's moved the approval of those minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, members. You know, I don't mind change as long as everything stays the same. And we've had some change here, so I'll have to get used to that. Ms. Hatch, Representative Johnson normally approves the minutes, and he's not here, and he was not here yesterday, so I'm casting the blame for this on his shoulders, not my own. Okay, so members, you now have a copy of the PowerPoint, and Ms. Hatch, please go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My apologies. I thought that you had the hand up before. My apologies for that. So you'll see slide 9 then, basically, again, is just a graphical representation of the previous slide that I just went through. Again, debt service only shows here as 1%, and there's a note there that it does not include the major debt service transfer that we make every year. In case you're curious, if we did include that, it would be an additional $213 million in that's our planned transfer for fiscal year 18, and $223 million for fiscal 19. Again, this is just another slice and dice of the entire fund by program and budget activity. So I'll do a little bit deeper dive then. We had some questions about what's included in the three main categories, program planning and delivery, operations and maintenance, and then agency services. So now I'm going to kind of transition us to do a little bit deeper dive in those areas. So program planning and delivery, we get sometimes a lot of questions and there's a lot of confusion about what's included in there. This is a category that we just find it really hard to name because there's a lot of stuff in there, and it's a little bit hard to figure out what the right name should be. But the bulk of this, and I'll show you some additional numbers with some additional breakdown, but the bulk of this is engineering, everything from initial scoping, environmental work, design, in some cases there's consultants involved in that, any of the engineering work that needs to happen, any of the design or project development work that has to happen. Some of that includes obviously right-of-way when we have to purchase it. A lot of that comes out of the SRC program, but some of it does come out of program planning and delivery. That probably the biggest right-of-way expenditure is also the folks that we have that actually purchase the right-of-way, take care of eminent domain types of issues. And so all of that acquisition that has to happen to get a construction project moving is included. It also includes developing of the construction plans, all of the construction plan reviews, and construction management, including managing of the contracts. As you might expect, these construction projects are very complicated, and often we have multiple construction contracts on each job. And so managing of the construction contracts is significant, and that all comes out of program planning and delivery, as does the on-site inspection. So all of the inspectors that we have actually on the project, inspecting everything from the materials that get delivered to the work that the prime or subs are completing on the jobs. We also have expenses that come out of this category, this program area, for research activities, for plan development, like strategic plans, things like Minnesota Go and Minship. The primary funding for those activities come out of this category. And all of our performance management, performance measures area come out of this. I should also say that areas like our entire, all of our bridge office, for example, comes out of this this category. All of our materials management work comes out of this this category as part of the engineering and project development.
Ms. Hatch, within this category, how much of this work is done by consultants?
Mr. Chair, if it would be okay for me to address that question later, I do have a few slides from now. I do have that number actually broken out for you.
That'll be
I think it's $11.5 million, if I remember correctly, but I'll show you that.
All right, great. And as you put together a project, at what point do you have to have all the funds in place for that project?
Mr. Chair, representatives, that's a great question. We have a four-year constrained plan that we, the STIP. We actually have a 10-year planning process. We call that the CHIP. And so in some cases, the scoping is not complete far enough out, you know, 6, 7, 8, 10 years out. We might have a rough estimate. Once it hits the STIP, it should be fiscally constrained. I say should be because in the bulk, nearly every case, they are in there at their full funded amount. They must be fully funded in that document. The document is actually intended to represent how we plan to program the federal funds, but because we didn't have any other mechanism, we show both the federal and state funds in that document. Once it hits the STIP, so 4 years or less from the time of letting, all of the funds need to be available and committed in the, for the project. There are some cases in which the project might change at some point once it hits those 4 years, and there might be some significant increase in cost. Maybe it's pavement that deteriorated worse than we thought it was, so rather than doing a just a rehab, we have to do a full reconstruction or some sort of bridge work. And in that case, that additional amount might be, I guess, what we would refer to as sort of an unfunded liability in the STIP. But before it goes to the next year of the planning in the STIP, it would need to be fully funded. In some cases, that happens because we get additional federal funds. In some cases, if we have additional appropriations from the legislature, we would kind of fill that hole. But the shorter answer to your question is once it hits the STIP, 4 years out or less, it would need to be financially constrained.
Well, thank you for that. And how much flexibility do you have within that as far as reallocating funds from project to project when necessary?
Mr. Chair, we have, in theory, we have wide latitude to do that. In reality, it's a lot harder than that. Once we have the STIP, and even if a local community, for example, knows that their project is in the CHIP years, it's very hard to move it because they have been working on it, we've been planning it, they know when it's happening. So, in theory, we can move any of those projects around. In practice, it's very hard to move a project. Now, projects do shift naturally. We might be developing a project for a letting next year, and there might be some significant issue that comes up on it. Some of the scope changes that I mentioned just a few minutes ago, for example, maybe the local participation piece is they're not able to fund, and then we have to maybe delay it to give them some more time. And in those cases, that's a mutual arrangement. They know that the project is going to shift. There are some cases where before we send it to letting, it's for whatever reason, it's not ready, and we might move that back a year and then pull a different project forward. But typically, those are the only cases that we do that with.
And finally, and this is somewhat loaded, but how do you deal with unauthorized federal funds that you believe will become available?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. We typically have all of the federal funds authorized by the legislature prior to the fiscal year beginning, and so we typically don't have a problem with that. Right now, we have a little problem with that, where we have $105 million in federal funds that we that really are available to us today, and we don't have authority to spend. And so those projects are not in the STIP. Those projects are on hold until we get specific legislative authority, and that's per Minnesota Statute 3.3005. And so if we don't get those funds, those projects will either be dropped, which we would not like to see, or if we do them, they would end up creating a domino effect that would shift everything else in the program for the next 4 years. So we're really up against the clock on that, sir.
I'll leave it at that. Go ahead.
So I'll move on to show you the numbers, program planning and delivery kind of by the numbers. This is where on this chart and in the future charts, you'll see where the word says partnerships. Again, it's nomenclature. This is really the special revenue fund that I was mentioning earlier. We've listed it here on the next number of slides that you'll see that look like this. We've listed it as partnerships because that's the type of funding or the type of arrangements we have in those special revenue funds typically in these areas. So, again, a partnership in the program planning and delivery area would be typically a partnership with a local entity where the city or county is doing a certain portion, or we're going to do the whole job, and they're going to just pay us their portion of the engineering, for example, and we'll put it here, and then we bill to their account as the engineering is completed. So you'll see, again, the trunk highway, federal, and then partnerships. The federal funds you see here is principally what we call state planning and research, and the kind of the bulk of the federal funds that we received is located there in the trunk highway section. If we use any for program planning and delivery, we use very few for program planning and delivery. The bulk of the federal funds are all in the state road construction area. And again, a graphical representation of that. And my apologies, I know this is impossible to read probably up here. Hopefully it's a little easier in your slide deck. The question was asked how much program planning and delivery is spent by each office and district. And so every area of the department that receives or has access to or any sort of budget allotment in fiscal 18 and 19 for program planning and delivery is listed on this chart. So you'll see, for example, our districts are listed. They receive, a large portion of that. A couple of areas I'll point out because you'll see it on the next two sections as well. You'll see it in operations and maintenance, and you'll see it in agency services. The very last line that says corporate accounts represent things like health insurance, severance, tort claims, workers' compensation, unemployment compensation, and some professional and technical contracts related to things like the physicals that employees have to go through in order to be eligible candidates in some of our positions might include things like our drug and alcohol screening program for our heavy equipment operators, things like that. So, and since this is an 18-19 budget, this is not actual expenditures, and so the reason it shows up here and will show up in the other two is that we don't know exactly yet, what our unemployment compensation expenses will be or whether those will be attributable to program planning and delivery, operations and maintenance. or agency services. And so we've prorated it across all three, again, because this is a budget rather than actuals. This is the next biennial spending.
Ms. Hatch, if we could just have a little more in-depth description of a few of these. First, the civil rights line, the third line down.
Mr. Chair, representatives, the civil rights category, this represents our DVE participation work, the work that they do with our contractors to ensure DVE compliance, on-the-job training programs, and those other federally required and state required civil rights activities.
Thank you. Environmental stewardship?
Mr. Chair, representatives, environmental stewardship is basically the oversight for all of our construction plans, environmental work. In some cases, that includes specific activities on projects that come up. In some cases, it's the plan reviews and design elements that relate to environmental work. That's completing all of those environmental assessments.
Metro.
Mr. Chair, representatives, Metro represents our Metro district. I should have mentioned that. That's a great question. So we have 8 districts statewide, I'm not sure if I have a map in here, but I can forward you. I can show you one here when we're done. But that represents our Metro district, which is the largest district that we have, and it represents the 7-county metro area plus Chisago County, and it's roughly a third of the department in both funding amounts and the number of employees.
So you have the 8 state districts plus the metros. So you have 9 and 12.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Metro is part of the 8 districts.
It's part of the 8 districts. So then why do we have 2 budget lines separated? So it's the part of that district that's outside of those counties you mentioned.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I'm sorry if I didn't explain that well. So we have a total of 8 districts statewide. You'll see on the list there it says District 1, 2, 3, 4, and then it skips to 6, 7, 8.
Oh,
uh-huh. This metro used to be an east and a west metro. So one was District 5, one was District 9. They were combined and referred to as metro.
So it's really District 5, but it's so special that it has its own name.
Mr. Chair, let's go with that. Yeah, I like that.
And finally, technical support.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, representatives, so tech support is, and there's more detail on all of this in the budget documents, but technical support is basically just what it sounds like. It's all of the engineering technical support components. That office provides technical support to all of the 8 districts. Actually, all of these, what we call specialty offices, do bridge, environmental stewardship, materials and road research, for example. We have our chief engineer here if you want more detail on that, but they provide all of the project management expertise. They provide things like our project management tracking that takes place in P6. They provide ASHTOWARE support. This is where my financial knowledge and the engineering kind of rub up against one another. I handle the finances, she handles the engineering. So if you'd like more detail, we can.
I'm not the only one hearing voices here. and so is any of that technical support contracted with Minute?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Minute. Do you use Minute for any of those technical support services?
Mr. Chair, representatives, you would see our Minute or our IT needs spread throughout here. The technical support would not be, Minute would provide some assistance to us with regard to the, for example, the applications that those folks use, but no, the technical support there is not IT technical support, it's engineering technical support.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll move on then. This gets back to your question earlier, Mr. Chair. So, again, in 2018, our current budget, again, that is spelled out in Chapter 75 from 2015, is set at $227 million. And of that, we expect to spend about 5.2% of that, or about $11.7 million, on external consultants. And these are consultants that we hire to do principally engineering plan development kinds of work. So then I'll go into our state road construction budget. Again, sometimes you'll hear this referred to as our hard construction. This is the actual construction that takes place on the road. And this includes both state and federal funds, principally for trunk highway system preservation, safety enhancement projects. So we like to think that all of our projects have a bent towards safety, but we would also say that there are some projects that are their principal purpose for doing the project is to improve the safety of a particular area. And so those would show up here as well as any system expansion. So again, this breaks it out with the current biennium mm-hmm. and the next biennium where we have spent the dollars. So fiscal 16 would be actuals. Fiscal 17 is actuals plus anticipated expenditures this year. And then 18-19 would be our planned expenditures for the next biennium. And again, a graphical representation of that.
Ms. Hatch, Representative Johnson has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is looking at fiscal year 18 and 19, I'm looking at the trunk highway funding, it's going down. Can you explain that?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this represents our statutory or our direct appropriation funding from the last biennial budget appropriation. It would not reflect our current forecast. So additional funding that might be available in the Trunk Highway Fund or that we've received from federal funds since then would not be reflected there.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Hatch, does that line include Trunk Highway Bond spending?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, it does not include Trunk Highway Bonds.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representatives, moving on. This, again, will break down our consultant use and the SRC. So, again, and we have a note down below that shows basically what we use the consultants for based on the last 5 years of spending. About 74% is used of consultant spending is used for architects and engineering. 17% is used for environmental services. So, again, these are consultants that help us to do that environmental work or assessments, studies. 6% for real estate or construction or building operations, and then all the rest would represent about 3% of spending.
Representative Hausman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was comparing this with a sheet in the packet that specifically talks about consultant spending, and it goes back to 2008, and of course we go from 15 to from 8 to 17 we go from 15 to 79, and that's where you pick up here mm-hmm. And then there's a note, it looks like per direction of the legislature using consultants to develop corridors of commerce projects for the shelf should additional funds be appropriated. Is that why that consultant line went up so dramatically, that direction from the legislature?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm actually not sure if that's directly as a result of that. I do know that when we have there are times when we have budget issues where we would do more consulting than we would be able to hire staff. And I think that could be part of why you see an increase, particularly from 2012 and on. But I'd be happy to do a little more research as to exactly what caused that increase and give you something more specific.
So, Representative Hausman, you're referring to this single sheet?
Right.
With some information about consultants on it. Members, you should all have that if you care to take a closer look at that. But thank you for that question. Ms. Hatch, please go ahead.
Okay. So now I'll move into our the second of our, what I kind of think of as on the operating side of our budget, are three big areas. So program planning delivery, I always think of like state road construction as just its own animal. And then we have on the operating side, program planning delivery, operations and maintenance, and then agency services. So in operations and maintenance, it's just exactly what you would think it would be. It's for things like snow and ice control. That's a huge expenditure we have. We also have huge expenditures in this area for materials that would include things like sand, salt, cable median barrier, aggregates, things like that. So stone ice control, ditch mowing, bridge inspection and maintenance, road surface repair, guardrail maintenance, cable medium barrier maintenance, and then all of our traffic control activities also take place. Again, that's on the sort of operations side of the operations and maintenance category.
So, Ms. Hatch, do you have a breakdown of these in number form coming? Right there.
Mr. Chair, I do have a slide that breaks, by those categories?
Yes.
I'm not sure if we have that included in the slide deck, but we can get it. We can get it to you even by what we call a product and service. And you'll see, I think that's reflected in, we have two other published reports that's reflected in that we'd be happy to get you as well.
Thank you. I just know that Representative Johnson is very curious about the ditch mowing number. I can just see it in his eyes. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, today I'm much more interested in the snow and ice control. I do hope to get home tonight, and I know tomorrow it will be a real challenge. But I'm confident that
Johnson.
District 7 will be out there on the road keeping 169 and 14 open for. Thank
Representative
you.
Representative Johnson, you are already in trouble for being late and not being here to do your job with the minutes. And now you've been funnier than the chair. How much more trouble can you get into in one day?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll try to get into a little more trouble. I want to provide the chair my excuse for being late.
Better be good.
It's a very good excuse, and I think you'll appreciate it. I was meeting with members from my county of the Minnesota corn growers, and of course you'll remember that the corn growers and the soybean growers have both passed resolutions supporting a 10-cent increase in the gas tax. Thank you very much.
The chair is looking at you. The chair is looking at him in stunned disbelief.
That's it for today.
Ms. Hatch, please go ahead
with
your presentation.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I will just briefly refer to those two reports in case that's interesting to you, because I think one of them you already have, the dedicated fund expenditures report. It does not break the expenses down by the products and services, but it breaks it down into some other categories that might be helpful, things like equipment, supplies, payroll, non-payroll. We also have another report that is out on the website. It's issued every December 15th. And we can certainly send you a link if that makes it easier. It's called the Major Highway Projects Report. And there's a section in the Major Highway Projects Report called Expenditures by Product and Service. And so we do break down the agency's expenditures and in big categories like by the districts by product and service. So categories like snow and ice removal, categories like bridge inspection, bridge repair, I don't have the list in front of me, but it's a pretty significant list. And we've worked really hard to try to have it be as, you know, sort of plain language, as readable as possible. So that's another report that I would refer you to. And we'd be happy to send you a link to that. Okay, so moving on. This is a graphical representation of the expenditures. I didn't really refer to this. This is exactly what we looked at before, only this is for operations and maintenance rather than the program delivery. But it breaks down the trunk highway spending, the any federal funds we received, and partnerships. Again, here the biggest partnership is damage restitution. In the program planning and delivery, the biggest partnership is partnerships with local entities for sharing construction costs. Graphical representation of it. And then this, again, is all of the areas, all of the offices within the department that are allocated to receive a portion of the operations and maintenance funding in fiscal 18 or fiscal 19 are represented here. So I'll give you a second to take a look at that. You'll see Chief Counsel is listed there. I should mention what that's for. That's for tort claims that we receive as a result of, you know, people hitting a pothole, things like that. Human resources, that might seem a little strange. Listed there, we have a graduate engineer program. It's a great feeder program. We often have a hard time attracting and retaining engineers, particularly right out of school. And so we have a graduate engineer program where they come in and then they go through a rotation program. And some of the time they spend rotating in areas that are operations and maintenance related. And so they're paid for out of this piece, and then they might go into areas that are related to engineering, program planning, delivery type activities, and then they would move to there and be paid out of the program planning and delivery. And we have very, very high success rates with that program. I hate to say it, but they're kind of they're inexpensive to hire, and then we train them really well, and they tend to love it there, and they stay, and we've had great success with that.
Ms. Hatch, if I'm not mistaken, you coordinate that program with the Center for Transportation Studies. Is that correct, or am I misremembering that?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that program is directly coordinated with CTS.
Okay.
So some additional information. So of the $292.1 million that is in current law for 2018, we expect about $51 million of that to be spent on materials. The three big expenditures are noted there: salt, fuel, as you might imagine, and then what we call cutting edges for the plows. They bolt onto the plow blades, and that's actually the surface that touches the road. And we go, as you might imagine, we go through quite a few of those. So, and they're not cheap. So those are the big three expenditures we have. We also expect to spend about $67 million for snow and ice activities in fiscal 18.
Johnson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the snow and ice. There's concerns in my area about enough snowplow drivers, especially permanent workers. Is that a problem statewide? And also, what percentage of that budget is devoted towards full-time professional snowplow drivers versus part-time consultant-type snowplow drivers?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is a great question. If I could, I'd like to answer it in kind of two pieces. One is to address I'm going to do it in reverse order. So I'm going to first address the full-time versus seasonal or 45-day type employees. So our preference always is to hire, of course, full-time, because we can train them up. They can do work for us. Snow and ice service gets a lot of press, if you will. It's kind of our flagship service. But actually, those same employees, we use them in the summer, and they're actually even used even more and needed even more during the summer to do our summer maintenance activities. And so so that particular group of employees is so critically important to the department. We do, so to address kind of the first part of your question, the bulk of those employees are full-time employees. And we used to hire more temporary, and sometimes we do have the ability to hire temporary employees, or what we call 45-day employees. And it used to be where we'd have a lot of farmers that in the winter would plow for us year after year after year on a 45-day temporary hire, where we could use them for up to 45 days. Don't need to be continuous 45 days, just 45 days during the season. That labor pool, we have seen significant shrinkage in that labor pool. We've also seen significant shrinkage in as the economy improves, and folks interested in even being a seasonal or a temporary. Part of the reason for that is our drivers need to be out there Christmas, New Year's, weekends, holidays, anytime they're called up, and they're usually out there for at least 12 hours, and then they're on a 12-hour rotation. So that work, as the economy improves and people have other options, that work and that labor pool is harder and harder to tap into. To kind of address the first part of your question, how we manage that usually is we actually have a lot of our plow drivers, a much larger percentage, in some cases up to 40% of our plow drivers, are actually engineers that should be designing projects, keeping projects on schedule, hitting letting dates. But since we can't find and we can't afford to permanently hire full-time employees like we used to, it used to be our entire plow fleet, drivers. We used to have enough to keep two trucks running, in other words, one truck every 12 hours on the road. We don't have the ability to do that anymore. In addition to that, we have had to put into position descriptions for engineers. So I was speaking to a little bit ago about how hard it is to get even engineering to come in, and that we have this grad engineer program. And part of that reason is because many of them don't want to plow. we don't have any option right now. We require them to get a CDL and to be able to plow. So we might have someone that's designing traffic operations or that's doing scoping or design on a project. And when it snows, they get called up by the maintenance supervisor, and they go get in a plow. And that project sits and waits until they get back to it, and that could take days. We have projects that get into really, really tight timelines because we pull engineers off of their design and make them go plow. So it is a significant problem for us. And if I may, Mr. Chair, one of the ways that we have really seen that we could address that in a really robust way that would really honestly, efficiently right-size the department, right-size the program, have the right staff both to plow and to do summer maintenance, and then to allow our engineers to actually do the engineering. And it would help us to be able to recruit effectively in both camps, is an initiative that we put forward and the governor did support. And it's called, we refer to it as workforce optimization. And so I would just, that is a significant operational issue for us. And I don't know if I was too windy in answering your question, but yes.
I'll follow up from him.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that response. What a sophisticated response to help us better understand the problem. Mm-hmm. So am I correct then that the governor has in his budget request increased funding so we can hire more people to work for MnDOT to make the whole operation more efficient and also make sure we got professionals running the snowplows? Thank you.
I have a question from Representative Gunther.
Just out of curiosity, since we have all these construction companies building roads for the state and highways, state, county, and so forth, and they don't do very much besides draw unemployment in the wintertime. Can we contract with them to plow our roads? Is there anything wrong with that, or do we do that maybe?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, for the state system, the state trunk highway system and the interstate system, we do not. We use all of our own forces. Part of the reason that we do that is because I really like the way you referred to that, Representative, that we have really professional plow drivers. And again, it's not just about plowing. If we outsourced all of the plowing, we would still need all of those employees in the summer to do all of our summer maintenance activities. And that is actually even a busier time for that group. In the winter, it kind of goes in fits and starts. If you have a three-day snow event, that's what they're doing. When they're off time, they're doing other things, of course, when we're not having them out plowing. But in the summer, we would still need those employees. And in fact, an OLA program review back in 1984, which we still have not been able to completely address, actually referred to that and said we really ought to staff up for the high point, and not the high point, but the midpoint, which we're not staffed up for yet. But that's where we should staff up for rather than have these kind of peaks and valleys. That report also mentioned a different way that we could budget, which actually we've also been putting forth. We put forth the last, I think, 3 years, a way to get our snow and ice budget isolated in its own appropriation or a sub-appropriation under operations and maintenance. And that would help us to protect. Snow and ice gets really complicated, but effectively what happens when we have high expenditures in snow and ice, we actually, because our budget is fixed, we actually take away funding that we had set aside for things like mowing, for things like guardrail repair or patching or paving in the spring and early summer. And so isolating that budget in its own sub-appropriation in the accounting system would allow us to make sure that we're not effectively taking from other areas that we really also need to do and preserve and protect, and would allow us to have a defined budget and then to seek funding from the actual fund balance if we go over that. Within a two-year time span, we had a $50 million swing in snow and ice expenditures. That's just really, really hard to manage without impacting other activities in the department.
A follow-up, Representative Gunther?
Mr. Chairman, I really believe that the people that built those roads can plow them just as well as the state employees can.
Mr. Chairman.
I know they have to learn them, but you can't know them much better than those people that built them.
Mr. Chair.
I have a question from Representative Sundin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the regarding the training of these people, you have your full-time employees that are doing a good job out there, and then you get some engineers that step in and some summer help that switches job descriptions. And now we're hearing that we could bring in more private people. Can you talk about the training that is involved on this on the snowplows? It's one job I would never want to have. But I wonder which out of the those two groups, the temporaries and the regular ones, which ones are knocking over my mailbox all the time?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would like to think it would be none of ours unless you live on an interstate or a trunk highway. So I apologize on behalf of the city or county. Our drivers actually go through quite extensive training, and in fact we have what we refer to as spot training, snowplow operator training that takes place at Camp Ripley. I believe it's a two-week program that happens every year, and so our drivers go through that. They test out. They have a rigorous testing program. You know, when you have a plow on the roadway, it's nearly the biggest machine out there, and we take that very seriously. I don't know if you've ever ridden in a plow. We would be delighted if you wanted to ride. I'm looking over at our chief engineer, but.
So could we run a plow from St. Paul to Hanska tomorrow? I'd be happy to ride.
But to ride in a plow with the driver, yeah, I would agree with you, Representative. It is not a. I've driven a plow, but you know, safely at Camp Ripley. I would never want to do it on the public roadway. It is a
follow up, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we can organize that field trip, can we get a guarantee from the department that this committee can ride in the front of the trucks rather than in the back?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. Thank
you. It's a seniority thing. Somebody else had a question. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd just like to respond to Representative Gunther that currently in most construction, in line of construction, unless work really drops off in the wintertime, which we are full-time employees, and in my 30 years plus working in the trades, I only have 6 months. I didn't even have 6 months. It was 2 months that I was off in the wintertime. So a lot of those people are working full-time for their contractors, and there isn't a huge supply of people sitting around collecting unemployment that don't have jobs in the wintertime anymore, unless the economy is really tanked.
Thank you. Ms. Hatch, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, then moving on to agency services. Again, this slide, which I'm on slide 25, if you're following along in your slide deck, this is, again, a category that is has just a lot going on in it. It includes everything from our legal department, legal compliance, tort claims. A lot of our tort claims that can't be specifically paid out of one of the other areas comes out of here. All of our finance area. Our technology investment management group, which is the kind of business entity that works with minute services, and then resources that we need for managing our workforce, so all of our human resources folks, including training and development department and so forth. Communications comes out of here, all of those kind of corporate service departments you might think of.
Ms. Hatch, I assume you have, obviously you have quite a bit of money, I shouldn't say laying around, but, that's encumbered for projects but not spent. What happens to the earnings on those funds?
Mr. Chair, if I understand your question correctly, when we've got money encumbered, what happens to the interest that's earned on
yes.
the funds? All of the interest gets credited to the Trunk Highway Fund, and then it gets picked up in our fund statement and put forward for appropriation.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, Representatives, then moving on, this shows agency services, again, expenditures, the same way we've seen them before. Trunk Highway, most of it is Trunk Highway partnerships and some other. The other is just additional funding that we might get through indirect. Thank you. I asked that question earlier. It is indirect. It is the indirect that we pay actually to MMB for the statewide system support, SWIFT, Semaphore, and so forth. And then again, this breaks down all of those areas that will receive or budgeted to receive a portion of this funding in the next biennium. So again, all of those kind of corporate service areas that you would think of. Administration, our audit department, our chief counsel, which is all of our legal services. I regret, but we are sued a lot. And so while the legal services amount might look large, it's astounding how much we spend there. All of the commissioner's staff, so myself, the other deputy commissioners, and all of the associated costs with that, there's several staff persons included there, our government affairs area, human resources, et cetera. So kind of going into building services, which is the biggest chunk of the agency services, agency management area. As I mentioned earlier, we have over 1,000 buildings, 1,075 buildings. That includes headquarters out in the districts, you know, their headquarters facilities. Most of you, I would guess, maybe have been to there to meet with our district engineer. Also, it includes salt sheds. It includes truck stations that are located throughout the state. We like the truck stations to be put in proximity to where the plow routes and the maintenance routes are to get those trucks back on the road as quickly as possible. But our building services folks, they are responsible for basically making sure that they're taking care of all of those facilities statewide. We also have some kind of specialty buildings that are things like if you've been up to our Min Road facility, and if you've not, here I'll give you an invitation. We'd love to have you come up to our Min Road facility. You've maybe seen it off of just north of Albertville on I-94 off on the right side. What would that be, the east side of the road? So we'd love to have you come up there, but that's sort of an extra building that we have. We also have our materials lab, our bridge office, central shop, things like that. Again, the way the expenditures are broken out by fund and a graphical representation of that.
Representative Drazkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hatch, 1,000 buildings. Mm-hmm. That's still sinking in. That's four people per building. You've got 4,000 employees, right?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll give you a little bit of a breakdown of the buildings. This might help. So we have 1,075 buildings. So some of those include, like, salt brine buildings, things like that, where we don't actually have people housed in. But we have 1,075 buildings that is located on 269 sites or geographic locations in the state. 137 of those are truck stations. 18 of those are larger facilities like headquarters facilities. And in the headquarters, I should say, they do also project development and design work as well. We have, as I mentioned, those kind of special services buildings, the Min Road facility, Arden Hills, Central Shop, our materials lab. There's one other I didn't make a note of. And then we have 173 salt sheds. We have 68 rest areas located throughout the state. So that doesn't equal up to 1,075, but that's the type of facilities we have. And then, as I mentioned, we have, you know, other on all of those sites, we would have maybe smaller garages, cold storage facilities. We would have salt brine buildings. Those have to be a separate building where we mix the salt and brine. And buildings like truck stations, for example, we have some truck stations that are very small that might have, you know, two or three or four trucks in them and don't have any, you know, like office workers, like no office space. And then others might be a larger truck station.
A follow-up, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Hatch. So tell us, Ms. Hatch, what is MnDOT being aggressive in moving more towards shared facilities with local counties and cities? I know we've got some, at least one in my district, and mm-hmm. I was heartened to see and hear about that. But tell us just quickly, and hopefully there's even more of that happens in the agency.
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, great question, and yes, we do. In fact, we partner with DNR. We partner with DPS, both Driver and Vehicle Services, as well as Minnesota State Patrol in nearly all of our larger facilities. And then we partner with the local cities and counties in many facilities statewide, including things like Mankato. The new Traska truck station, for example, is a kind of a one that folks know most about. But up in District 2, Crookston, and throughout the state. absolutely, we do that.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hatch, in regards to the rest areas, just curiosity question. Mm-hmm. Are they maintained and cleaned by MnDOT staff, or are they subcontracted out?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they are subcontracted out to a company called Greenview, and we are actually required in statute to do that. And so we do receive so some of our operations and maintenance funding does go to pay the Greenview salaries, but that is in statute.
Thank you.
Representative Bernard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick question. I from a committee you had done before, or somebody had done before on transit committee, they talked about the ABC ramps. Mm-hmm. I believe they're kind of the responsibility stationed in the bike ped division. Are there any federal dollars that are used to pay for any administrative costs for the ABC, or any state dollars, or does it all come from the operations of the ABC ramps?
Ms. Hatt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. So the ABC ramps that you're familiar with in downtown Minneapolis, interestingly enough, they're actually bridges that were 90% federally funded. So they're actually bridges over 394 that actually have ramps built on them. That's a distinction I always make because it makes the difference. But, yes, all of the operations for those facilities, including, you know, the city of Minneapolis actually operates those facilities and does the majority of the administrative work on those facilities, and that's all paid for out of the funds that come from parking at the facility.
So I just want to follow up to be sure this is clear.
Up,
yes, thank you. So there is nobody in MnDOT that's receiving that funds from the state or the federal mm-hmm. government are being used to pay for their positions, was mm-hmm. any responsibility for ABC ramp operations?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would I could follow up with you on that. Lisa Austin is an employee with the department. She's, as far as I'm aware, the only person that is dedicated to the ABC ramps and their maintenance and operations and things like that. She may be paid for from the Trunk Highway Fund, but she also may be paid for from the revenue that comes from the ramps. I could double check on that and get back to you. I just don't know off the top of my head how that employee is paid.
Mr. Chair, that would be great. I'd like to know anybody who's in the chain of command in that and who gets paid for that help, where the funds come from. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representatives, moving on. So, anyway, this is a picture of how our federal funds are split out. Oh, I kind of breezed over this slide. So this is our special revenue funds. We had a question about what do we have allocated in our special revenue funds. So this shows by budget activity where we have where we expect to have expenditures in our special revenue fund this next year. And then on the right-hand side, so the numbers represent the total expected expenditures in fiscal 18 and 19 and then the biennial total. And what you see under where it says significant partnerships, those are activities that represent maybe what we would call the bulk of those dollars, not all of those dollars, but maybe the biggest chunks or the biggest players of those partnerships would be noted there. And if you want more breakdown, I think we did send over a more detailed list of all of the partnerships, but we can get you more if you need that. And then, again, this shows the federal funds. We also had questions on take-home vehicles and vehicles that are assigned to employees. So the difference in those two categories are assigned vehicles would be a vehicle that would stay at the facility or stay at the garage and then be checked out as needed, but typically assigned to a single person or a small group of individuals that work on a particular project. An example might be a truck that has some specialized equipment where there's maybe one person who does that specific work. It could be maybe it's survey work, let's just say. And so that vehicle might be assigned to that employee because they're able to keep all their gear in there, all their equipment. And yet that truck goes out and then it comes back and it stays at the facility. And then a take-home vehicle would be a vehicle that is assigned to a particular individual and they're allowed to take it home as part of their normal work. Often that is the case with employees that typically don't come to a facility. They maybe are on a construction job, and so they go basically from home to the construction job every day, and they use that vehicle to do all of the work that needs to happen in the course of the day, going to different locations, different sites, maybe going to meetings with the contractors at their locations, things like that. Those vehicles may also include cases where we have an inspector, like a commercial vehicle inspector, that might go every day to a different location and inspect vehicles at a, you know, trucks or motor carriers, things like that. In a couple of cases, we have employees that tend to travel long distances. So our we have a person in operations that is nearly every day of the week in a different part of the state doing meetings and or training and so forth. And so that's an example of another person that might use a take-home vehicle. And this is a chart that breaks it out by office and rest to provide that by office or district. When I say office, I kind of mean office or district. They're kind of one and the same.
Ms. Hatch, I think we have another question from Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hatch, I have a constituent who sells vehicles to the department and other entities, and I was wondering, is there a determined mileage when you replace a vehicle, or is it, do you have a lease with a fleet, and how long a lease is that, and what is the decision that goes into upgrading the fleet, and when?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Hatch?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so if we're talking specifically about kind of passenger vehicle or light-duty truck kind of fleet, which is the bulk of what this would be, we do have an area in our central shop that manages all of our fleet usage, and so they have data on what is the optimum time for a vehicle, like at what mileage marker or what time, you know, in service is it time to switch that vehicle out. I don't have that with me today, but I'd be happy to get it to you. I do know that they put out every month a report that shows vehicle usage, and we do rotate vehicles. So if we have a vehicle in a particular area that's not getting the usage, we might rotate a high-usage vehicle out for a lower-usage vehicle to try to even that out. And then on whatever their optimum schedule is, that we might retire a vehicle or go to upgrade it. In some cases, if it's low miles and running well, we may not touch it at all and for a little bit longer. But I'd be happy to get you more information on how they calculate that.
Representative Rosenthal? Good. Representative Draskowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hatch, that program with these take-home vehicles, is it audited by the department and or the legislative auditor?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Hatch?
Mr. Chair, Representative, both, frankly. I don't know off the top of my head the last time the legislative auditor audited it, but I do know that our internal audit does look at it. We also have state policies, and we have department-wide policies that kind of govern the use of those vehicles and who might be eligible for those vehicles. You know, out of 5,000 employees, we only have about 120 that are assigned a vehicle or get a take-home vehicle. So overall, it's a small number. 120, though, is still 120 additional vehicles. Employees that they're not allowed to commute with the vehicles, and so that's clearly spelled out. And if they do, by chance, if they're assigned a vehicle and they, let's say they go to a meeting Brainerd, and then they come home and maybe the next day they end up coming to the office, so it might be commuting, they are required to, on their timesheet, to note that, and so they are charged for that commuting. But we have a form that they have to read and fill out and sign and attest to how the vehicle's used, as well as their supervisor and up the chain. So we do have some internal controls around how vehicles are assigned and how they're used. And we do review it routinely. I don't know the last time OLA came in to do it, but I know our internal audit team does it on a kind of a rotating basis.
And members, I'd like to direct your into your packets. The department did provide three other sheets. One of them is assigned vehicle guideline. There's also the MnDOT policy position statement and MnDOT policy guidelines, too, that may be available for you as well. Representative Draskowski, do you have a follow-up, or you're good? Thank you. Ms. Hatch, you may continue.
Sure. So moving on, the next section is related to questions that we received around transfers out of the Trunk Highway Fund. particularly to the governor's office. And so so this is the last 2 years, what has happened in regard to that. Starting with fiscal year 2017, you'll see that the amount that we received from the governor's office was at $98,900. I should say that we actually do receive a lot of service for that. We receive the governor and his staff sit on the on a number of councils and interact with a number of lawmakers, congressionally in particular, as well as folks at the federal DOT. They also, the National Governors Association, for example, they do a lot of work for us, and so. So we believe that the $98,000 is a. We believe we received $98,000 in service from them. In last year, out of the transit assistance account, our transit assistance area, they paid $39,600. The general funded areas that we charged about $19,000 to, the county and the city state aid areas paid a portion of that. You may be wondering why the trunk highway did not pay a portion of that, and that is because it is in statute that the trunk highway cannot pay any expenses related to personnel at the governor's office. And so we did not do that. You'll notice the previous year, however, we did have an expenditure from the trunk highway fund that was not actually a it was a payment. It was not a transfer. But in full disclosure, it was a payment that was made to cover that portion of the bill from the NGA, the National Governors Association.
Ms. Hatch, if I could just ask a question. In regards to the municipality and FISAW, what do we get from the governor's office that helps the department for that transfer?
Mr. Chair, representatives, county state aid and the municipal state aid system would receive the same thing that the trunk highway system receives in that regard. Things like standards development, which they're currently working on. We do support the counties and the cities with engineering work. In fact, we have folks that work principally on trunk highway projects that work on those projects as well and get charged for that. We also... you know, sometimes there are issues that come up, particularly either local issues or issues where contractors or constituents contact the governor's office and then they work backwards with us. We connect with our local state aid folks and they connect with the cities and counties. And so there's a lot of activities that take place. There's a lot of touch points that do take place and can take place in a year.
Thank you. And just as a quick follow-up, how do we keep track of what that might be, or is it this just kind of a general formula that you use?
Mr. Chair, representatives, do you mean how we split this out?
Correct.
A general formula that was, we did not keep track or do right. Time coding, things like that.
Okay, I think
general proration.
Thank you. I think Representative Renbeck has a question.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that's your last slide, is it, of the slide deck? So I wanted to go back and just a couple questions about transit. And I'm looking at... pages 17 and 18 of the budget narrative. So it talks about, just curious about some of these programs that are mentioned, the Minnesota Walks program, the non-motorized traffic monitoring program, the state, principally those, but I mean, so a number of programs, Share the Road, State Bicycle Map, etc. Are these all statutorily authorized? And so there's an expectation that we will be spending money in these areas, or how do they come about?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe they are statutorily authorized, although we will check on a line-by-line item and get back to you. I believe they are statutorily identified, and activities related to bike pad walking are also included in the transportation goals that were set forth for the commissioner in, I don't have it with me, 161, I believe. And so there is definitely a direct tie to the purpose of the department and those transportation goals that are listed there. And I believe that these are. I know that some of the reports, for example, are specified in statute and required reports.
Okay, and a follow-up, please?
Yes,
Mr. Chair. And then also mentioned several times here is that the Transit Office partners with the Met Council for the planning, design, and construction of light rail, transit, and commuter rail. Is there a specified in statute relationship between the two, and who is doing what, or how, what controls, I suppose, the interaction and how it's paid for?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so a couple of things related to that. As the MPO in the Twin Cities, we are required actually by federal statute to coordinate with them and make sure our planning process and our plans coincide with the TPP and all of the plans for the Met Council. So we do have a requirement to do that and to coordinate. If the Transit Office is coordinating specifically with Met Council on transit activities, and our Transit Office does not do transit in the metro area, they do the Greater Minnesota Transit. But in cases where they might, rub up against each other in terms of providing service or connectivity, our transit assistance area, our Greater Minnesota Transit area, would cover those costs. And versus the Met Council, we don't pay for Met Council activities, but we do coordinate quite a bit with them, both because it's federally required and because it in many cases makes the most sense to coordinate with them on in areas where we're going to have services that kind of touch each other.
Representative Renbeck?
Well, Mr. Chair, and I would be interested to see any budget detail, as to the cost of that, because there must, it must be allocated out somewhere.
So. Ms. Hatch, if you can get that to us, appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to.
I think Chair Torkelson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking, Ms. Hatch, at this spreadsheet's got lots of numbers on it. It's the open and statutory appropriations. And on the first page, about three-quarters of the way down under passenger rail, there's a line for $2.6 million that's apparently from the economic recovery funds. I believe those are date back quite a ways. Can you give us a little more information on that?
Ms. Hatch?
Mr. Chair, yes, so in 2009, the department received American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds, ARRA funds. The bulk of those funds, particularly the funds that were related to road and bridge projects, have been completed actually a couple of years ago. We did have funding that did come from ARRA. It was not eligible for road and bridge funding. It came specifically from the FRA to move some projects along, and I can't remember if that is. I believe that's related to the NLX, but it's possible that it could be related to the work on the second train to Chicago. And if you'd like, we can get back to you on specifically which that is. But that that was some additional funds that we received that were basically taken back from, I believe, another state that couldn't use them all, and then they were reappropriated to us, and they were still originated from the 2009 funding.
I see. Thank you.
Any follow-up, Chair Charcoal?
Well, not a direct follow-up, but another area. We do traffic counts on various stretches of roads around the state. I know we do. Do we do counts at all on bicycles?
Ms. Hatch?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I honestly don't know the answer to that. But we'd be happy to get back to you on that.
Well, I know that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not used to having to go through the chair.
And you can come back and sit here if you like.
No, you're doing great. We do have requirements to add bike paths to various projects, bridges, et cetera. And it would be interesting to know how those counts post-construction look. So if you could get some information on that, I'd appreciate it.
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, I just don't know off the top of my head, but we'd be happy to go take a look. And if we have that data, we'll be certain to get it done.
Thank you so much, and Chair Torkelson, you're always welcome to interject all the time. So. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess my question would go, that $49,700 to the National Governors Association just kind of sits out there like a sore thumb. Is that the total payment that the state of Minnesota makes to the National Governors Association? Is that the portion that MnDOT pays? Is there a reason it comes out of Trunk Highway? If it's not the total payment, how is it divvied up between the different departments? I guess it just opens a door for me for a thousand different questions that I could go down. So if you could expound and get back to us on exactly how much comes out of what places and how it is determined that it should come out of Trunk Highway as opposed to something else.
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know what the total bill is. I don't see the total bill. This was the portion that we were billed.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, so how does it determine that it comes out of the one fund that should be dedicated to roads and bridges and it comes out of Trunk Highway to pay this bill instead of some other fund in MnDOT?
Ms. Hatch, do you know why it comes out of the Trunk Highway Fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do. It comes out of the Trunk Highway Fund because the bulk of the activities that the governor's office gets involved in is related to Trunk Highway funded activities. In fact, the bulk of the activities in the department are Trunk Highway activities. And even areas like Greater Minnesota Transit, where it might show a sizable number, or even the state aid area, the bulk of that is pass-through funding. So the vast majority of the activities that take place in the department, the number of employees that are in the department, et cetera, are Trunk Highway eligible and Trunk Highway funded employees. And how that was determined, I couldn't tell you, but I can tell you that was what we were billed.
Representative Hall?
Well, thank you. I think that's where I'm going to spend some more digging, is trying to figure out how that was determined and see if it can be redetermined. Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hatch, I'm looking at the budget narrative on page 30. This is a multimodal system passenger rail section, and it talks about a Twin Cities to Chicago high-speed rail project. Is that the Zip Rail project?
Ms. Hatch?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Twin Cities to Chicago, no, that is not the Zip Rail project.
Representative Drazkowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hatch, so what does that represent then? What is that?
Ms. Hatch?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is Amtrak service right now from the Twin Cities to Chicago, and there is an interest in adding a second train to Chicago, and they've been working on that for a while. And there's also, I'm not an engineer, but my understanding is there are segments of track that need to be straightened or more straightened at some portion along that track in Minnesota to allow that service to happen and to allow that service to happen more efficiently and faster. It is not high-speed rail. It is the existing rail service that is passenger rail with Amtrak.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Hatch. So all on the same page, it talks about planning on an emerging passenger rail corridor along the I-35 corridor. Can you quickly tell us where this one came from?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't. I don't have any more detail on that. I'm just not aware of it. But we'd be happy to connect with our passenger rail folks to get more detail on those projects.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Hatch. And members, again, this area, this department continues to develop these ideas without really any consultation, apparently, with the legislature. Very problematic. But thank you, Ms. Hatch.
Representative Renbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I wanted to question, we've heard the commissioner state often that MnPass is a transit project, MnPass lanes. And so my question is, is there any discussion, or does the Metro Transit budget contribute anything to the development of those lanes? And if not, I mean, is there discussion about that?
Ms. Hatch?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, they do not contribute financially to the development of those lanes. Currently, in fact, the MnPass operations, we do split revenue with the Met Council based on MnPass tolling. And in fact, it's a little bit confusing because each of the corridors has a different statutory formula to determine that tolling. And in some cases, The revenue split is before the operational expenses are covered. In some cases, it's after. And so there is a cost-sharing arrangement, but it is an arrangement in which the MNPAS revenue is shared with the Met Council, and the department does the engineering and the preparations for the corridor and the design of the addition of the lanes, et cetera.
Representative Rinbeck.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Any other questions of the committee?
Excellent.
Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back just digging a little deeper into the consultant's situation, I've had some anecdotal information that indicated that a number of the consultants, or some of the consultants anyway, are former DOT employees. Do you have any information along those lines?
Ms. Hatch?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question. I do know that there are some employees that are no longer employed with the department that do work for consultants out in the, particularly in the engineering sphere or the planning sphere. I don't have any rationale for that other than they can certainly make more money if they work for a consultant. And so many times, in fact, we have the same issue with planners. Planners coming into the department, they work, you know, right out of school or right out of grad school, work in the department for a couple of years, and they can make substantially more. They get recruited away to a contractor or a consultant, and there's nothing we can do about that. At least that we've found. We've actually, I've asked the question before, is there anything, even with these grad engineers, you know, we train them, we get them trained up, can we require them to stay for a certain number of years? And we're just not able to do that as a public entity. But yes, there are definitely former employees of the department that now work for consultants.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, thank you. So have we seen a migration of those services from within the department to utilize more consultants for those sorts of services?
Ms. Hatch?
Mr. Chair, I can honestly with a straight face tell you that I have absolutely no reason to believe it has anything to do with the fact that former employees might be at these consultant companies. That is purely a factor of...
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry.
But have we seen where some of this work used to be done in-house at the department? And now we're utilizing consultants to do that work instead. Have we seen a migration of this work from in-house to out-house? That was a bad choice of words. I'm sorry.
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, I think the migration or the increase in that consultant usage is a matter of the construction program, the time that we have to deliver the projects on, and the current staffing levels at the department. That would be the reason that we use consultants.
Thank you. If you have any more information on that, I'd sure appreciate you seeing it.
Thank you. I think Representative Sandin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering about the turnover of people in the department you just mentioned. I'm just wondering, maybe you would apply for a DEED grant for all the training you're doing for people. But does that indicate to us that some of the professionals in the department simply aren't being paid enough if they keep migrating?
Ms. Hatch?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if you want my honest opinion, I would say that yes. That when you look, and there's a number of ways you can kind of slice and dice data, and I know MMB has looked at this, but frankly, if an engineer is going to come to the department or they're going to go to a consultant and make, you know, a third or half or twice as more, you know, over and above what they make here, for most folks, that's not a hard decision. And frankly, there used to be a time when I love public service. I'm not a widget counter. I like to come to work and I like to see what I do actually impact the greater society. And I've worked in other departments. I've worked in the Department of Corrections. I've worked in the Department of Human Services, worked at Education, and I'm here. So there was a time when state employees, government employees, typically had a slightly lower salary, but the benefits were phenomenal. And I would say the benefits compared to the private sector still are really good. And that there was longevity. Like if you had a state job, you were really in a kind of a steady job. And I think that for a number of reasons, some of which, you know, some of those have changed a little bit. We've seen, budget shortfalls, and we've seen layoffs, and we've also seen, the cost of things go up, and so employers are paying a little bit more of a share of that. I get that. I'm not saying that's unreasonable. But we've also seen changes in just the generational mix. And so it used to be that, in the baby boomers or even the Gen Xers, I'm a Gen Xer, you kind of get in, you want to devote your life to a certain type of work. What we're seeing with the millennials and even the digital generation that's coming up behind them is that they're not tied to that sort of thing, so they're much more free to move around. And as a state, if we don't have competitive wages and or some other real selling feature that can attract that talent, across state government, there's the conversation about how do we attract and retain talent and not be just a feeder pool for the private sector. Not that we need private sector folks, because we can't scale up and scale down like that. We do need to tap into those. But yes, we're finding it hard to maintain a workforce with competing salaries.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Representative Sundin?
No, just from me to you, thanks for not wandering off on us.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've heard this same thing said before. The state, our legislative auditor, Mr. Nobles, has just talked about that he also has the same issue where he brings people in right out of college in his legislative auditor department. And once those people get trained and get experience, they leave and go elsewhere for the private sector because they make a lot more money. Mm-hmm. And there's this myth out there that government employees make all sorts of money, and all they do is that they're at the trough, I think is one of the terms that people mm-hmm. use. But this is a problem he's talked about in the Government Operations Committee, that he gets these new people in, gets them trained, gets them to know how to do what they got to do their jobs, and then they leave to go to the private sector and make a lot more money. So he has a lot of brand new people. He has a lot of real long-time people that are there, that are staying there because they've got their pensions there, but there's a dearth of people in between, and mm-hmm. sometimes we need, that sometimes it's because they're not paying enough money to the people to keep that talent that we train here as a state, so, and I know that's an issue we have all across the state.
Thank you for that comment, and I guess the question I asked, so where does that put us as legislators as well, right? Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to follow up on Representative Drazkowski's comment. I didn't have this in front of me when he was speaking, but when I look at this multimodal, the passenger rail projects, really it is not MnDOT coming up with any of those ideas. I mean, what they're doing, every one of these, as I see this, all of the energy comes from those local communities and the conversation is there. So, for example, there's as much conversation in Winona and Red Wing about more service to Chicago than anywhere. And I think at least what I understand is that I-35, people in southern Minnesota, particularly an area like Northfield or Mankato, there's just huge local conversation and emotion around these projects. So MnDOT, I think, is responding to local demands and not coming up with them yourself.
Any comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, nope, that's accurate. There's also a Passenger Rail Advisory Commission that I think we have one person that sits on just to be the tie back to our passenger rail area. But it is exactly as you describe. It is the local communities and other partners in the community that are bringing those projects forward.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is opening an interesting discussion because this is exactly, members, what we're seeing happen around the state, is we're seeing an interest group, and probably nearly every one of our committees would like the state of Minnesota to build its trains and to shoulder the burden of that upon the backs of all the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota at the same time. Without the contemplation of the legislature and actually the elected officials that are there to spend that money on behalf or on their behalf to make that decision. So therein lies a problem, is that we have these interest groups out there, many of them that have a nostalgic affection for trains, who are developing this interest building up using grant funds and other means these project ideas and then latching on to MnDOT and our other state resources and then tying up those resources on our behalf without the legislature ever acting upon that or making a decision about where the route is going to be or whether or not one is even needed. And the process is actually to develop along this, and we've seen in our communities with this insane zip rail idea that developed down there. There's not even a process to determine whether there's a need, even though there's supposed to be a needs assessment process. It doesn't even happen. So, members, we got to do a lot of work in this area because this is happening haphazardly across the state. And MnDOT is there working with them to happily use any resources it has to build as many of these as they can and as quickly as they can to encumber taxpayer resources in the process. So rather than fund nostalgic interests that happen with a small interest group, a small percentage of people in each of these communities in Minnesota making the decisions and driving the train or wagging the tail of the dog, we need the head of the dog, the elected people of this state, setting the direction and making the decision. So that's the frustration I think that I have sensed, and I think many on this committee also share. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't think I heard a question, so I'll move on to Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Petersburg. I'm slightly familiar with the situation in Northfield. I don't think it's fair to call that an interest group. It's a group of citizens, and it's led by an elected official, a city councilwoman. And so they're very open. They're open about their meetings. They're talking. They see advantage to it, to possibly passenger rail going down I-35. I think that's the prerogative of citizens. In my work, I applaud the efforts of my citizens, and I respond to them. Good example, it's in another arena, but the Friends of Fort Ridgely are saying, we want to keep that golf course open. I'm not so sure I personally agree with that, but I honor what they're trying to do as citizens, and I'm working with them to make them help them accomplish that. It's kind of a view of how you see a role as a legislator, maybe. I don't see it as the state looking down on the citizens. Rather, I see it coming up from the citizens, and that's the evidence I'm seeing, whether it be in Northfield or in Fort Ridgely or the efforts in St. Cloud to extend the rail to St. Cloud as well. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'm going to just kind of bring us back to the item on hand, which is the department's presentation. So I think, Representative Hausman, you have another question?
Mr. Chair, I was going to make the same point that Representative Johnson did. I just didn't think I'd ever heard of Citizens of Minnesota being referred to as an interest group before, and it sort of sounded like, wait a minute, citizens don't get to decide, legislators get to decide. And I thought we represent them and their wants and needs. But speaking of the needs assessment, that is very much a part of every one of these corridors. There has been extensive work on a needs assessment.
I think Representative Draskowski, if you could keep it short.
I will, Mr. Chair, and thank you. And the citizens, members who don't get to decide, are the citizens who have to pay for this. So there might be a small group of citizens. I've known at least one of these groups with their nostalgically driven ideals. At least two of the members of one of the groups has HO model scale trains in their basement. Okay? So it's the rest of the people out there that are forced then to pay the tax burden with which these are developed. And we have to have a more organized approach to it because now, members, every community can go forward and bring this and encumber the taxpayers of Minnesota without any thoughtful process to it.
Members, we're running short on time, so Representative Rembeck, you have the final question?
Very, very quick questions. The Office of Traffic Safety, we didn't hear about that today. Is that under you or under DPS? And then secondly, who would I speak to about commercial vehicle titling issues? There seems to be something going on there.
Ms. Hatch?
Chair, Representative, there is an Office of Traffic over at DPS. Everything that you'll see in these materials that are referred to the Office of Traffic, we do have an Office of Traffic Safety and Technology, and they do everything from managing our traffic controls for projects to designing the traffic systems to managing the ESS, the signals and things like that. So no, that does exist at MnDOT. And the second part of your
commercial vehicles,
I'd be happy to connect with you, or one of our government affairs folks could, and we'd be happy to connect you with that office director.
Okay. And just to clarify, so there's an Office of Traffic Safety in DPS, and then an Office of Traffic Technology, Safety Technology under you?
Ms. Hatch?
Mr. Chair, Representative, Traffic Safety and Technology, yes, that exists at the Department of Transportation. Okay. That's actually under our chief engineer.
Okay. Thank you,
Commissioner.
And Ms. Hatch, I realize that we got to the last slide and we didn't really let you conclude if you had any final statements.
Mr. Chair, no, thank you. It was a delight to be before you, and anything we can provide you, please let us know.
Well, I appreciate you coming here, and thank you for your presentation. Members, I do have an exciting offer for all of you. Speaking of snow, later on tonight and tomorrow, we have been offered the opportunity to ride along with a snowplow, if you would like. And if anyone is interested, you may talk to Jennifer Witt. And if you can't make it tomorrow and you would like to do that some other time, please let her know. And I have the phone number here if you want to. But it would be an opportunity for you to get up in a big truck and see what they have to deal with in regards to snow. So thank you for that offer. With that, I think our next meeting is next Tuesday, same time, same place. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.